Cassette 6, Side 2.
Chapter 19. May 29th, 1963. The maitre d'hotel at the top of the Cove restaurant said,
"Dinner, sir, s'il vous plaît?"
Yes. He led them to a spot with a commanding view of the La Jolla Cove below. Waves broke into foamy white sprays beneath the floodlights.
"Is this table okay?"
Gordon nodded while Penny rolled up her eyes. After the man had bestowed the huge menus and gone away, she said,
"God, I wish they'd cut out the accent business."
"What is it, madame? You no like the phony talk?"
Gordon said. "My French isn't great, but..." She stopped as the waiter approached. Gordon did the wine ritual, selecting something he recognized from the fat book. When he looked around, he saw the Caraway sitting some distance away, laughing and having a good time. He pointed them out to Penny, and she duly entered the fresh datum in their running tally. But they did not go over to report the latest figures. The colloquium lay 5 days in the past, but Gordon felt uneasy in the department now. Tonight's splurge at the top of the cove was Penny's suggestion, to lift him out of his moody withdrawal. Someone thumped him at his elbow.
"I open it now,"
the waiter said, working at the bottle.
"Must let it breathe."
"What?" Gordon said, surprised.
"Open to the air, you know. Breathe."
"Oh.
Yes, sir."
The waiter gave him a slightly condescending smile. After he had left, Gordon said, "At least he has the smile down pat.
Are all the high-class restaurants around here like this?"
Penny shrugged. "We don't have the old-world culture of New York, and we didn't get mugged walking over here, either." Gordon would normally have sidestepped the "now what you New Yorkers ought to do" conversation, but this time he murmured,
"Don't cretch about what you don't know."
And without thinking about it, he was talking about the days after he moved away from his parents and was living in a cramped apartment, studying hard and for the first time really sensing the city, breathing it in. His mother has assigned Uncle Herb to look on him now and then, since, after all, he was living in the same neighborhood. Uncle Herb was a lean and intense man who was always landing big deals in the clothing business. He had a practical man's disdain for physics.
"How much they pay you?"
he would say abruptly in the middle of discussing something else.
"Enough if I scrimp."
His uncle's face would twist up in the act of weighing this, and he would inevitably say,
"Plus all the physics you can eat, eh?"
and slap his thigh. But he was not a simple man. Using your intelligence for judging discounts or weighing the marketability of crewneck sweaters, that was smart. His only hobby he had turned into a little business, too. On Saturdays and Sundays, he would take the IRT down to Washington Square Park early to get a seat at one of the concrete chess tables near McDougal and West 4th Streets. He was a weekend chess hustler. He played for a quarter a game against all comers, sometimes making as much as $2 in an hour. At dusk, he would switch tables to get one near the streetlight. In winter, he would play in one of the village coffee houses, sipping lukewarm tea with an audible slurp, making it last so his expenses didn't run too high. His only hustle was to make his opponents think they were better than he was. Since any chess player old enough to have quarters to spare inevitably also had an advance case of chess player's ego, this wasn't hard. Uncle Herb called them potsers, weak players with inflated self-images. His game was no marvel either. It was strategically unsound, flashy, but built out of pseudo-traps tailored to snare potsers who thought they saw an unsuspected opening suitable for a quick kill. The traps gave him fast wins to maximize the take per hour. Uncle Herb's view of the world was simple. The potsers and the mensch. He, of course, was a mensch. "You know what was the last thing he said to me when I left?" Gordon said abruptly. "He said, 'Don't be a potser out there.' And he gave me $10.
Nice uncle,
Penny said diplomatically. And you know, last Friday, the colloquium,
I started to feel like a potzer.
Why? Penny asked with genuine surprise. I've been standing firm on the strength of my data. But when you look at it, Christ, Dyson would have given me a break, would have backed me up if there'd been any sense to it. I trust his judgment. I'm starting to think I've made some dumb mistake along the way, screwed up the experiment so bad nobody can find what's wrong.
You should trust your own.
That's what marks the potzer, see? Inability to learn from experience. I've been bulling ahead.
The compote, sir,
the waiter said smoothly. Oh, God, Gordon said with such irritation that the waiter stepped back, his composure gone. Penny laughed out loud, which made the waiter even more uncertain. Even Gordon smiled, and his mood was broken. Penny's forced merriment got them through most of the meal. She produced a book from her handbag and pressed it on him. It's the new Phil Dick. He glanced at the lurid cover. The Man in the High Castle. I haven't got time.
Make the time. It's really good. You've read his other stuff, haven't you?
Gordon shrugged off the subject. He still wanted to talk about New York, for reasons he could not pin down. He compromised by relating to Penny the contents of his mother's latest letter. That distant figure seemed to be getting used to the idea of him living in flagrant sin. But there was a curious vagueness about her letters that bothered him. When he first came to California, the letters had been long, packed with chatter about her daily routine, the neighborhood, the slings and arrows of Manhattan life. Now she told him very little about what she was doing. He felt the void left by those details, sensed his New York life slipping away from him. He had been more sure of himself then. The world had looked bigger.
Hey, come on, Gordon, stop brooding. Here, I brought you some more things.
He saw that she had planned a methodically joyous evening, complete with door prizes. Penny produced a handsome cross pen and pencil set, a Western-style string tie, and then a bumper sticker. AU plus H2O. Gordon held it between thumb and index finger, suspending it delicately in the air over their table as though it might contaminate the veal piccata.
What's this crap? Oh, come on, just a joke.
Next you'll be giving me copies of The Conscience of a Conservative.
Christ. Don't be so afraid of new ideas.
New? Penny, these are cobwebbed.
They're new to you.
Look, Goldwater might make a good neighbor. Good fences make good neighbors. Isn't that what Frost said? Little literary touch for you there.
But Penny, he's a simpleton.
She said stiffly.
Not so simple he gave away Cuba.
Huh?
He was honestly mystified. Last October, Kennedy signed it away. Just like that.
She snapped her fingers energetically.
Agreed not to do anything about Cuba if the Russians took their missiles out.
By anything, you mean another Bay of Pigs?
Maybe,
she nodded sternly.
Maybe.
Kennedy's already helped out quite enough fascists. The Cuban exiles, Franco, and now Diem in Vietnam. I think...
You don't think at all, Gordon. Really, you've got all these Eastern ideas about the way the world works, and they're all wrong. JFK was weak on Cuba, and you just watch. The Russians will give them guns, and they'll infiltrate everywhere, all over South America. They're a real threat, Gordon. What's to stop them from sending troops into Africa, even? Into the Congo?
Nonsense.
Is it nonsense that Kennedy's chipping away at our freedoms here, too, forcing the steel companies to back down when all they did was raise prices? Whatever happened to free enterprise?
Gordon raised a palm in the air. Look, can we have a truce?
I'm just trying to shake you loose from those ideas of yours. You people from the East don't understand how this country really works.
He said sarcastically. There might be a few guys on the New York Times who mull it over.
Left-wing Democrats, she began,
who don't...
Hey.
Hey.
He raised his palm toward her again. I thought we had a truce. Well, all right. Sorry. Gordon studied his plate for a moment, distracted, and then said with dawning perception, "What's this?" "An artichoke salad." "Did I order this?"
"I heard you."
"After the veal? What was I thinking of?"
"Well, I'm sure I don't know."
"I don't need this. I'll flag one of those funny waiters."
"They're not funny, Gordon. They're queer."
"What?"
he asked blankly. "You know, homosexual."
"Fags?" Gordon felt as though he had been deceived all evening. He dropped his signaling hand, suddenly shy.
"You should have told me."
"Why? It doesn't matter. I mean, they're all over La Jolla. Haven't you noticed?"
No.
"Most of the waiters in any restaurant are. It's a convenient job. You can travel around and live in the best spots. They don't have family obligations. Most of the time their family wants nothing to do with them, so..."
She shrugged.
Gordon saw in his gesture an unaffected sophistication, an ease with the world, which he suddenly envied very much. The way their conversation had shifted from topic to topic this evening bothered him, had kept him off balance. He realized that he could still not get a grip on the real Penny, the woman behind so many different faces. The comic Goldwaterite lived right alongside the literature and arts major, who in turn blended into the casual sexual sophisticate. He remembered opening the bathroom door at a faculty party last year to find her seated on the toilet, her blue gown crescenting the bowl like a wreath of flowers. They had both been startled. She held a square of yellow tissue in an upraised hand. Her heels dug into the grouting between the triangular brown tiles of the floor, so her toes canted cockily into the air. The low seat made her seem bottom-heavy. Between pale thighs, he saw the unending oval yawn. A dark sheath of hose swallowed most of her legs, yielding only to the descending tongues of her garter belt. His jaw had sagged open with indecision, and then he stepped in, mouth closing on the possibility of faux pas. The mirror on the far wall showed a startled stranger, puzzled. He shut the door behind him, drawn to her. "You can see this at home," she said impishly. With a studious deliberation, she patted herself, unmindful of him, and let the yellow paper flutter into the mouth of the water below. She half-turned on the seat, pressed the chipped ceramic handle. An answering gurgle took away her business from his prying eyes before she arose. Standing, smoothing her dress, she was taller and somehow challenging, an exotic problem. In the bleached tile pocket, she appeared luminous with purpose, a penny he had not known. "I couldn't wait," he said with a warmth that sounded strange to himself, considering that it wasn't true. He edged by her, unzipped. The mildly pleasurable gush. Release. "Getting domestic, aren't we?" Penny raised one edge of her lipsticked mouth in the lyric curve of a half-smile, seeing the mood in him. "I guess so," he said lazily. Outside, his colleagues were discussing superconductivity while their wives made shrewd observations on local real estate. The women seemed to have a better grip on what was real. Penny's smile broadened, and he concluded with a quick spurt that narrowly missed the seat. He gave himself a wobbly, drying shake, tucked himself in, and dried the seat with more of the yellow tissues. He had never felt this simple and open with a woman before, in such a rich, enameled air. Not wanting to hang on to the moment for fear that it would burst, he kissed her lightly and popped open the door. Outside, Isaac Lakin leaned against the wall, studying the Bruegel prints in the shadowed hallway and awaiting entrance to the bathroom.
"Ah," he said as they emerged together. "Up to something."
A simple deduction. Lakin's eyes moved from one to the other as though he could glimpse the secret, as though he had just seen a new facet of Gordon. Well, maybe he had.
Maybe they both had.
Gordon,
Penny urged him back into the present.
You've been going off like that all evening.
She looked concerned.
He felt a sudden spurt of irritation. The dream Penny was soft and womanly. The one before him was a nag. If you're going to do that, why not just talk about it?
He nodded. Her programmed night out, full of forced gaiety, had begun to wear on him, and the sudden shifts in his emotions bothered him as well. He normally thought of himself as rock steady, unmoved by passing notions. "Got a call from Saul today," he said stonily, fleeing his own thoughts. "He and Frank Drake are going to get time on the big radio telescope in Greenbank, West Virginia. They want to study 99 Hercules.
If they receive a signal, it will prove your case?"
"Right. It makes no sense, but..."
"Right. Why no sense?"
"Look, I mean..." Gordon waved a hand in exasperation. One of the waiters took this as a signal and began to advance. Hurriedly, Gordon motioned him away. "Even if you bought the story whole, the tachyons and everything, why think there should be radio signals? Why both? The whole point of using tachyons is that radio's too slow."
"Well, at least they're doing something."
"Were you a cheerleader in high school, too?"
"God, you're a nasty bastard sometimes."
"Wrong time of the month?"
"Look, Saul is trying to help."
"I don't think that's the way to solve the problem."
"What is?"
When he waved away the question with a faintly disgusted look on his face, she persisted.
"Really, Gordon, what is?"
"Forget it. That's the best way. Just hope everybody else will forget it, too."
"You don't really..."
"Sure I do. You should have been at that colloquium." She let him cool for a minute and then murmured,
"You were confident a week ago."
"That was a week ago."
"At least you could work on it."
"Cooper's candidacy exam is 2 days away. I'm going to concentrate on helping him prepare and then on getting him out. That's my job." Gordon nodded abruptly as though having a job to do resolved all issues.
"Maybe you should try something like what Saul's doing."
"No point."
"How can you be so sure?"
She folded her arms, sitting back in the rattan chair and looking squarely at him.
"Have you ever thought about the rigid way scientists work? It's like military training."
"Bullshit."
"What do they teach you? Write down everything you know about a problem, set it up in some equations, and most of the time that's enough in itself, right? You just push the equations around a little and you've got the answer."
"Not that simple," Gordon said, shaking his head. But to himself, he had to grudgingly admit that there was some truth to what she said. Assign symbols, making the X's and Y's and Z's the unknowns, and rearrange. Made-to-order thinking. They were all used to it, and maybe it hid some elements of the problem if you weren't careful. Dyson, for all his wisdom, could be dead wrong simply because of habits of mind.
"Let's have chocolate mousse," Penny said brightly.
He looked up at her. She was going to make this evening end right, one way or the other. He remembered her perched on the toilet and felt a warmth steal over him. She had been both vulnerable and serene sitting there, performing an animal function amid a gauzy gown. Pert and oddly elegant.
"Was your dinner excellent, sir?"
Gordon peered at the waiter, trying to estimate if he was queer.
Yes. Yes.
He paused. "Lots better than Chef Boyardee." The expression on the waiter's face was worth the price of the meal. Chapter 20. May 31st, 1963. Albert Cooper's candidacy examination began well enough. Gates, a high-energy physicist, started off with a standard problem.
"Mr. Cooper, consider two electrons in a one-dimensional box.
Can you write down for us the wave function for this state? Gates smiled in a friendly way, trying to diffuse the tension that oral examinations always had. The student nearly always balked somewhere along the line, unable to summon up some simple piece of physics purely because of his own skittering nervousness. Cooper worked his way through an opening piece of the problem, sketching the lowest energy state. Then he stalled. Gordon could not tell if this was simple funk or a calculated delaying tactic. Lately, students had hit upon the frowning, silent stall as a method for extracting hints from their committee. Often it worked. After a moment, Gates said, "Well then, should the spatial part of the wave function be symmetric?" Cooper responded eventually, "No, I don't think so. The spins should be..." And then, halting now and then, he successfully got through the rest. Gordon felt uneasy as Gates led Cooper through a series of routine questions, all designed to find out if the candidate knew the general background of the thesis problem he proposed to attack. The air conditioning hummed with vacant energy. Cooper's chalk scratched and squeaked on the board. Gordon eyed Bernard Carraway, the astrophysicist. No trouble there. Carraway looked bored, impatient to be done with this ritual and get back to his calculations. The fourth and last member of the committee was the only problem, Isaac Lakin. As senior professor in the field of Cooper's thesis, his presence was unavoidable. Gates finished his simple questions, and Carraway, blinking sleepily, passed to Lakin. "Here it comes," Gordon thought. But Lakin was not so direct. He took Cooper through a discussion of Cooper's own experiment, usually safe ground for the student, since that was what he knew best. Lakin stressed the theoretical underpinning for the nuclear resonance effects. Cooper wrote down the scaling equations, working quickly. When Lakin probed deeper, Cooper slowed, then stopped. He tried the stalling tactic. Lakin saw through this and refused to give Cooper any meaningful hints. Carraway began to take an interest, sitting up straight for the first time during the examination. Gordon wondered why a student in difficulty always provoked more attention from a committee. Was it the hunting instinct? Or a proper professorial concern that the student, presumed to be accomplished until he proved otherwise, had suddenly betrayed a fatal ignorance? Either answer was too simple, Gordon concluded. By now, Lakin had Cooper on the run. Lakin made him frame a clear picture of the theoretical model and describe the underlying assumptions. Then Lakin cut Cooper's explanation to ribbons. His statements were vague, his reasoning sloppy. He had neglected two important effects. Gordon sat absolutely still, not wanting to interrupt, because he still clung to the hope that Cooper would right himself after being blown over in this quick storm and begin to answer correctly. That hope faded. Gordon remembered Lakin relating a comment he had written on a thesis some years ago. "Young man, there is much in this work which is original and much which is correct. Unfortunately, what is correct is not original, and what is original is not correct." Carraway joined in with a few incisive questions. Cooper seemed to make headway, then reverted back to his withdrawal mode, stalling for time. But in a 2-hour examination, there is more than enough time to uncover weaknesses. Carraway listened to Cooper's floundering replies, eyes still half closed, but now obviously alert, a sour expression spreading across his face. Gates peered at Cooper as if to understand how a student who had appeared bright only moments before could now be in such trouble. When Cooper turned to answer a sally from Lakin, Gates shook his head. Gordon decided to step in. It was not a good idea to defend your student very much in the candidacy examination, precisely because it was so obvious, and it implied that you, too, conceded the student's defects. Gordon spoke up, interrupting the flow of Carraway's probes. He pointed out that in the time remaining, the committee had to consider the form and details of Cooper's experiment, and they hadn't touched on that yet. This worked. Gates nodded. Cooper, who had been standing with his back pressed to the blackboard, smiled with evident relief. The committee room filled with the small sounds of hands riffling through papers, bodies shifting position in uncomfortable chairs. The earlier mood was broken. Cooper could repair some of the damage. 5 minutes passed smoothly. Cooper explained his experimental setup, elaborated details of the rig. He passed around samples of his early results. Lakin gave these papers scarcely a glance. Instead, he slipped some pages of his own into the set of data and passed them to Cooper. "My concern here, Mr. Cooper, is not only with the easy-to-understand results. I am sure the committee will find them unsurprising. What I wish to know is whether they are correct."
"Sir," Cooper said in a thin voice,
"we all know there are odd features in your work. Could you explain these things to us?"
Lakin pointed at his pages, face up on the table. They were traces showing the sudden interruption of smooth resonance curves. Gordon peered at them with a sinking feeling. The rest of the examination seemed to go by very quickly. Cooper lost a certain calm distance he had successfully kept through the earlier questioning. He explained the spontaneous resonance effect in halting sentences. He would rush forward through an explanation he knew, and reaching the end of it, back away from its implications. He tried to edge around the question of what caused the effect. Carraway, now visibly interested, drew him back to it. Gordon's interjections did nothing to stem the flow. Gates began to second Carraway's skepticism, so that Cooper spun from Lakin to Carraway to Gates, meeting fresh objections as he turned from right to left.
"This issue is at the heart of the thesis," Lakin said, and the others nodded. "It must be settled. Only Mr. Cooper knows the truth of the matter."
Everyone in the room knew they were talking about the messages and Gordon and Saul Schripper, not merely about the correctness of Cooper's electronics. But this examination was a way for the faculty to express their professional judgment of the issue, and on this ground, the battle had to be fought. Gordon let it go as long as he dared, eating into the 2 hours. Finally, he said,
"This is all very well, but are we keeping to the point? You have seen the data..."
"Of course," Lakin shot back.
"But are they right?"
"I submit that this question is not what we are considering. This is a candidacy examination. We pass on the suitability of a topic, not on the final outcome."
Gates nodded.
Then, to Gordon's surprise, Carraway did too. Lakin was silent. As though the question had been settled, Gates asked Cooper an innocuous question about his setup. The examination wound down. Carraway slumped in his chair, eyes half closed to his own interior world, the spark gone out of him. Gordon thought wryly of what the taxpayers would think of their half-awake public servant, and then recalled that Carraway followed what were for theoreticians standard working hours. He would arrive at noon, ready to substitute lunch for breakfast. Seminars and discussions with students took him into the evening. By then, he was ready to begin calculations. That is, real work. This early afternoon exam was, for him, a waking-up exercise. Gordon's real work began as Cooper left the room. This was when the thesis professor listened carefully to the comments and criticisms of his colleagues, ostensibly for future use in directing the thesis research of the candidate. A subtle tug of war. Lakin opened by doubting Cooper's understanding of the problem. True, Gordon conceded, Cooper was weak on the overall theory, but experimental students were traditionally more concerned with their detailed lab work, stroking their apparatus, Gordon called it, to provoke some much-needed mirth, than with the fine points of theory. Gates bought this. Carraway frowned. Lakin shrugged, conceding it as a tied point. He paused while Carraway, and then Gates in turn, expressed some misgivings over Cooper's occasionally sloppy work on basic physics problems. The two electrons in a box, for example. Gordon agreed. He pointed out, though, that the physics department could only require students to take the relevant courses and then hope that the knowledge sank in. Cooper had already passed the department's qualifying examination, 3 days of written problems followed by a 2-hour oral examination. The fact that Cooper's grasp of some points was still slippery was, of course, regrettable, but what could this candidacy committee do? Gordon promised to press Cooper on these subjects, to, in effect, browbeat the student into making up the deficiency. The committee accepted this rather standard reply with nods. So far, Gordon had skated on relatively firm ice. Now Lakin tapped his pen reflectively on the table. Tick. And slowly, almost languidly, reviewed Cooper's data. The true test of an experimenter, he said, was his data. The crux of Cooper's thesis was the spontaneous resonance effect, and this was precisely what was in question. The thesis is an argument, let us remember, not a stack of pages, Lakin said with dreamy ease. Gordon countered as best he could. The spontaneous resonance phenomenon was important, yes, but Cooper was not primarily concerned with it. His topic was much more conventional. The committee should look at the spontaneous resonances as a kind of overlay, occasionally obscuring the more conventional data Cooper was trying to get. Lakin countered in earnest. He brought up the Physical Review Letters paper, which carried the names of Lakin, Bernstein, and Cooper. The final thesis would have to mention it. And this, of course, a sad, weary glance toward Gordon, means that we must bring up the entire issue of the interpretation, which has been placed upon these interruptions of the resonance curves. I disagree, Gordon snapped. The committee must consider all the facts, Lakin said mildly. The fact is that Cooper is going for a standard problem here. It has not been so advertised. Look, Isaac, what I do has no connection with this thesis and this committee.
I really rather believe, Gates broke in, we should focus on the possibilities of the experiment itself.
Quite so, Carroway muttered, rising from his half-sleep.
Cooper will probably not deal with the message theory at all, Gordon said.
But he must, Lakin said with quiet energy.
Why? Gordon said.
But how can we be sure his electronics gear is functioning right? Gates put in.
Exactly, Lakin said.
Look, there's nothing that special about his equipment.
Who can say? Lakin said.
It contains a few modifications above and beyond the usual resonance rig. These, if I understand them correctly, a slight note of sarcasm here, Gordon saw, were designed to increase sensitivity. But is that all they do? Is there not some unforeseen effect, something which makes this experiment, this apparatus, pick up new effects in the solid in question, indium antimonide? How can we say?
Good point, Gates murmured.
What sort of effect are you thinking of, Isaac? Carroway said, genuinely perplexed.
I do not know, Lakin conceded. But this is the issue, precisely the issue.
I disagree, Gordon said.
Now, I think Isaac is dead right, Carroway murmured.
There's some justice to it, Gates said, reflecting. How can we be sure this is a good thesis topic until we know the equipment will do what Cooper says it will? I mean, there's Isaac here who has doubts. You, Gordon, you think it's okay, but I feel we ought to have more info before we go ahead.
That's not the purpose of this exam, Gordon said flatly.
I believe it to be a legitimate issue, Carroway said.
Gates added,
so do I.
Lakin nodded. Gordon saw that they were all uncomfortable, not wanting to broach the issue buried under the detail of Cooper's apparatus and the niceties of theory. Still, Gates and Carroway and Lakin thought the message hypothesis was bullshit, pure and simple. They weren't going to let the issue slide by. Cooper couldn't explain all his data, not the interesting parts, anyway. As long as that riddle hung in the air, this committee wasn't going to pass on a thesis. Also, it was not simply a question of conflicting theories. Cooper was weak in some important areas. He needed more study, more time peering at textbooks. He had never been a particularly brilliant classroom student, and here it showed up in spades. That, plus the muddy issue of the messages, was enough. I move that we fail Mr. Cooper on this first try at the candidacy examination, Lakin said mildly. He needs more preparation. Also, this matter of the spontaneous resonances, a glance at Gordon, should be resolved. Right, Gates said. Carraway said drowsily, already picking up his scattered papers. But look, Gordon, Lakin murmured with a kind of tired friendliness, that is a majority of the committee. Could we have the forms? Gordon stiffly handed over the university form for the examination, on which faculty could sign and write out either yes or no to the question of whether Cooper had passed. The form came back across the table with three no's. Gordon stared at it, still off balance, still not sure the whole thing was over. It was the first time he had shepherded a student through this examination, and now the student had failed. A rather uncommon event. The candidacy was supposed to be a putz of an exam, for Christ's sake. Gordon thought suddenly of the conventional theory of scientific revolutions, where paradigms overtook each other, old replacing new. In a way, the message theory and the spontaneous resonance theory were paradigms erected to explain one bunch of mysterious data. Two paradigms arguing over a scrap of experimental bread. It almost made him laugh. The scraping of chairs and shuffle of papers roused him. He muttered something to each of the men as they left, still dazed with the outcome. Lakin even gave him a handshake and a lightly delivered, "We do have to straighten this out, you know," before leaving. As Gordon watched Lakin's retreating back, he saw that to the other man this was a regrettable incident involving a junior faculty member who had gone off on a tangent. Lakin had abandoned the softer ways of persuasion. He could no longer come to Gordon and gently urge him to give up his notions. That kind of conversation would lead nowhere, had led nowhere. Their personalities didn't match, and maybe that was in the end the most important thing in research. Crick and Watson hadn't got on with Rosalind Franklin, and that prevented their collaboration on the DNA helix riddle. Together, they might have cracked the problem earlier. Science abounded with fierce conflicts, many of which blocked progress. There were great missed opportunities. If Oppenheimer had broken through Einstein's hardening isolation, perhaps the two of them could have gone beyond Oppenheimer's 1939 work of neutron stars to consider the whole general relativistic problem of collapsed matter. But they hadn't, in part because Einstein stopped listening to others, cut himself off with his own drowsy dreams and a complete unified field theory. Gordon realized he was sitting alone in the bleak room. Downstairs, Cooper was waiting for the result. There were joys to teaching, but Gordon suddenly wondered whether they were worth the bad moments. You spent three-quarters of your time on the bottom quarter of the students. The really good ones gave you no trouble. Now he had to go down and tell Cooper. He shuffled his papers together and left. Sunlight streamed in yellow blades through the corridor windows. The days were getting longer. Classes were over. For a moment, Gordon forgot Cooper and Lakin and the messages and let a single thought wash over him. The blessed long summer was beginning.
This ends side two of cassette six of Timescape. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 7.